I'm going to talk about some work I did with some of the guys at the Department of Agronomy and Horticulture in Nebraska. What we're trying to do at this stage is to bring down the temporal scale at which models are tested, to get away from some of the seasonal stuff we've been seeing earlier and try to focus on some of the newer technologies that allow us to test our models at finer scales of temporal resolution and to try to get perhaps a better constraint fix on our ability to model water deficit effects on cropping systems. The key question we're asking in this particular presentation are soybean maize rotations net source or sinks of carbon, and how is the carbon storage capacity of the system affected by irrigation? So the model we're using, those of you who know my work know that I use a model called EcoSys. Key components of which consist of a full radiation balance. So there's no direct calculation of evapotranspiration. It comes out of the radiation balance, which is solved for dominant and subdominant canopies, as well as soil, snow, and ground residue surfaces. It's coupled with water uptake through a root system. There's full gas exchange, greenhouse gas exchange, through soils and plants. There's a complete water balance, which is driven by the latent heat flux that comes from the solution to the radiation, the energy balances. Complete carbon exchange, autotrophic, heterotrophic respiration, as well as gross primary productivity. The gross primary productivity comes out of a Farquhar-type model, which is buried at a leaf level and scaled to a canopy level. And finally, a complete set of nitrogen transformations with which carbon transformations are coupled. What we're going to be looking at today is how to model soil plant atmosphere water transfers. This is done using a hydraulic-based model with a bunch of soil layers, through which water moves from a soil water potential through resistances in the soil and radial resistances in the root. These are coupled with axial resistances through a multi-layered root system, accounting for capacitance effects. This then controls water uptake by the canopy. This is equilibrated with the canopy evapotranspiration based on stomatal conductance or stomatal resistances that are imposed to water transpiration from sunlit and shaded leaf surfaces in a multi-layered canopy, and this then in turn is coupled to the canopy energy balance, which is solved with in conjunction with the boundary layer resistance to get exchange with the atmosphere. And of course, the latent heat flux is what gives you the transpiration from the canopy as well as the evaporation from the soil surface. So it's a fully coupled hydraulic scheme. We're going to test this with some eddy covariance work that was taken by Shashi Verma and his group in Nebraska. So we'll test against eddy covariance measurements of energy and CO2 exchange. We've also got a bunch of soil chamber measurements taken at the site so we can resolve the carbon balance into its soil and crop components, as well as TDR measurements for the different irrigation treatments. So the way we start off with the model testing is we want to look at how soil plant atmosphere water relations change under contrasting weather events. For this first set of data that we took from 6th to 15th of August, I should just mention, first of all, before we get going, we typically conduct our model test only after spinning the model up for several years, in this case 20 years, to ensure that our model testing is independent of the initial conditions of the model. So we've spun this model up for 20 years under ambient conditions before we start conducting these tests. So here we are in 2002 during August. What was interesting about this period is we had a rising temperature indicated by the red line in the top graph that may not have come through strongly on the precision. You can see the rising vapor pressure deficits in the middle graph, though, and this gives us a chance to see whether we're capturing crop water response under changing dynamically changing weather conditions. And in the bottom, you can see here precipitation events controlling soil water contents measured by TDR and modeled for the two, the irrigation and the dryland treatments. So can we capture a high water deficit effect and subsequent precipitation on crop water relations? The top diagram here shows our stomatal conductances for the irrigated and the dryland treatments. You can see the dryland treatment stomatal conductance declining in the presence of higher water vapor pressure deficits. You can also see the reduction in latent heat flux, both modeled and measured, that comes about with the rising water vapor pressure deficits in the atmosphere. And that has a distinct effect, as indicated by that lower arrow, in bringing on mid-afternoon or midday declines in CO2 uptake, Just a note on the sign convention here. Negative values represent effluxes, so when you see a negative value for an energy exchange, you're looking at an efflux of energy, be it latent or sensible heat, for the carbon flux. Again, the positive values represent influxes of carbon, and negative values effluxes. So you're seeing the influxes during the day and the effluxes at night. And you can see during the day, you have declining influxes in the rain-fed treatment, reflecting the declining stomatal conductance. You also see smaller effluxes at night, reflecting reduced CO2 fixation during the day, as well as constraints on soil respiration imposed by drying soil. With the irrigation, you can see there's a brief return of latent heat flux, a brief rise of stomatal conductance. In the upper diagram, a brief return of latent heat flux to close to irrigated values, and a brief return of CO2 fixation, or rise of CO2 fixation to close to irrigated values on the day immediately following the rainfall, but then a gradual decline back to rain-fed values on the subsequent 2 days after the rainfall. This is for maize. There's similar values for maize during 2003. What we have here is a period of rising temperature, resulting in rapidly rising vapor pressure deficits, and this gave us an opportunity then to see how our modeled water response would respond then to rising dryness in the atmosphere. And on the bottom, we have the irrigated and the rain-fed water contents, showing a very dry soil under the rain-fed, a wetter soil under the irrigated. And we want to see now, can we capture water relations as they change during this period of rising temperatures and rising vapor pressure deficits? You can see in the top diagram then, rising vapor pressure deficits causing declining stomatal conductance during the 10 days of comparison. You can also see declining latent heat fluxes with respect in the rain-fed treatment with respect to those in the irrigated treatment, again brought on by the rising vapor pressure deficits. And in the bottom diagram, you can see declining CO2 influxes with respect to those measured under irrigated conditions, brought about again by the rising vapor pressure deficits in the presence of lower soil water contents and hence lower soil water potentials. What you're seeing then here is the effect of the hydraulic scheme in constraining transpiration or evapotranspiration during soil drying, during declining hydraulic conductivities, declining root conductivities, and declining stomatal conductances, as indicated in the upper diagram. So it's really this combined hydraulic scheme that's causing the declines in the CO2 influxes to occur during this period of water deficit, exacerbated water deficits by the rising vapor pressure deficits. We can aggregate the CO2 influxes on each day and to try to see how they affect the daily values over the entire course of a growing season. The upper graph there is the daily net ecosystem productivity. It's the aggregated carbon exchange for the soybean crop measured and modeled, and for the bottom diagram, the same for the maize crop. You can see here those dashed lines represent the period during which we did our more detailed comparisons during periods of contrasting weather. You can see in the lower diagram the rapid decline in the net ecosystem productivity brought on by those rising vapor pressure deficits during August is tracked in the model. So this allows us then to track seasonal changes, which are a little difficult to see perhaps on an hourly basis. So as we conduct our testing, we try to start with the hourly, the diurnal change in the water relations indicated by the hourly changes in vapor pressure deficits and manifested in the changing distribution of energy dissipation between latent and sensible heat, and the impact of that changing distribution on CO2 flux. We then aggregate to daily values to try to track the seasonal exchange. And we then progress from there to, we also look at the CO2 fluxes from the soil. One of the things that comes out very strongly is the much larger CO2 effluxes you measure from the soybean in the first year following maize than in the second year from maize following soybean. We attribute that to two causes. One, you get a lot larger residue carryover from maize into soybean, and therefore more rapid heterotrophic respiration of those residues during the soybean year. Secondly, there's a significant contribution of biological fixation, the carbon cost of biological fixation in the soybeans, which contributes again to the larger effluxes that you see in the upper diagram versus the lower diagram. There's also an effect of soil water drying. You can see, generally speaking, the irrigated values are deeper down, indicating more rapid effluxes. And it's important to try to capture the constraints imposed by soil drying on respiration from the soil, as well as to net carbon exchange by the plants, in order to capture a total effect of water deficits on carbon exchange by ecosystems. So again, you see there the very rapid respiration typically measured from soybean crops, and again, captured in the model and attributed in the model to those two factors that I just discussed. All right, well, of course, you can always check against accumulated biomass for the irrigated and the dry land treatments for the soybean and the maize phases, but I regard these tests by themselves as being fairly weak, and I only just start looking at them once tests have been conducted at finer scales of temporal resolution, because I think you get better constraint at those scales. But anyway, for whatever it's worth, those are the biomass accumulation curves for the irrigated and dryland treatments in each of the 2 years of the experiment. All right, we one of the key things we need to look at in this whole carbon balance business is something called the net biome productivity. Now, that's really the sum of a lot of different influxes and outfluxes of carbon. I won't go into the details of the gross primary productivity, net primary productivity, litter, and heterotrophic respiration, out of which that value comes. But just if you look at that red row down at the bottom, what we end up with if we aggregate all the carbon fluxes, both measured and modeled, and we account for the removal, the harvest removal, and the grade, which is the line immediately above the NBP, we come up with a rather negative value for the soybean phase of over 200 grams per meter squared per year. That's over 2 tons of carbon per hectare per year. In the irrigated, a somewhat smaller removal in the rain-fed. However, fairly small gains in the maize. The main point, therefore, to note is that although the net biome productivity of the maize crop, once you've taken out the yields, is positive, it's a fairly small value with respect to a much larger negative value for the soybean. So that overall, the crop here is a net source of maybe 40 to 80 grams carbon per meter squared per year for this rotation. And that seems to be present in both the modeled and the measured results. If we want to look at the long-term changes, we can run this model over, for example, 100 years using repeated sequences of 2001 to 2004 weather, which is what was available at the time of writing. One thing I'd like to point out is that the net biome productivity of the maize-soybean rotation was less than zero. However, if you were to seek to corroborate that by looking only at the 0 to 0.2 meter depth, you would see gradually, in the model anyway, gradually accumulating carbon at that depth. However, the gains in carbon at that shallow depth are being more than offset in the model in any case by losses deeper in the soil profile. So if you look at the total soil profile, 0 to 2 meters, you actually see gradual soil carbon gradual carbon losses occurring. And in the model, that's attributed to inadequate replenishment of deep soil carbon by annual root systems, which tend not to be very deep or to extend deep in the soil, only over very brief times of the year. So I think it's important when we try to look at carbon exchange by ecosystems, look not just at the near surface, which is the tendency at the moment, but we need to be able to look through the entire soil profile to see whether changes are occurring at depth that we don't capture with those shallow measurements. So conclusions, because I know it's late at lunchtime. We're gone to the point now where we have correlations between modeled and measured CO2 fluxes of greater than 0.8, indicating we're at the stage now where there's only about 20% or less of variation in eddy covariance fluxes, which we cannot explain by the model. And these are, I think, largely attributed to random errors in eddy covariance measurements, which are in the nature of about 20%, according to a number of studies that have been conducted. So I think we're at the point now where we can model with some degree of accuracy eddy covariance measurements of CO2 influxes and effluxes from these ecosystems. If we aggregate these fluxes, the model fluxes and the measured fluxes, we find that the NEP of an irrigated and rain-fed soybean was maybe minus 30 and minus grams per meter squared per year. That's a net carbon source. That's the net ecosystem productivity. However, when we start subtracting out the grain yields, we find that we get a fairly, the net ecosystem productivity of the maize is very large. However, when we start subtracting the the grain yields from the net ecosystem productivity to get net bioproductivity, then we find that actually this ecosystem is rather a considerable source of carbon on average. The long-term model runs indicated that the rain-fed, no-till maize soybean rotation at Mead would gain perhaps 13 grams carbon per meter squared per year in the upper 0.2 meters of the soil profile, but it would lose about 30 grams carbon per meter squared per year from the entire soil profile, and that again reflects the net bioproductivity that we model for this ecosystem. So that the measurements, if corroborated in the upper 0.2 meters, might be misleading. If we irrigate the maize soybean rotation over that same period of time, we would raise soil organic carbon by perhaps 6 grams per meter squared per year over rain-fed values over a period of about 100 years. However, that value would be offset by carbon costs of irrigation of 10 to 20 grams carbon per meter squared per year for the energy requirements to apply that water. And there's also an issue of carbonate degassing, which seems to come into the calculation of irrigation carbon costs, which also needs to be accounted for. Overall then, we indicate only limited storage or opportunity for long-term soil carbon storage in irrigated or rain-fed maize soybean rotations under the conditions typical of the U.S. Midwest. And I think that's all I've got.
Thank you.